So welcome to the Intern Whisperer. Our show is all about the future of work and innovation. And today's guest, I'm very excited. I've known her for at least 2 years, is Eileen Bellestock. She is the CEO of Bellestock Consulting and serves as an ed tech strategist who understands and promotes the critical relationship between technology and education. She is a published author, writing about educational technology, educational leadership, data privacy, and cybersecurity in academic and professional journals. She has been acknowledged as one of the 2020 Top 100 EdTech Influencers and 2022 EdTech Digest Leadership Award finalists. Eileen, welcome to the show. I'm so excited.
Yeah, I am too. Thank you for inviting me.
We've known each other for a few years, and we get to see each other at the FETC conference, so it's awesome.
I know. It's the only time I meet people, my friends of mine, is at these conferences.
Yeah, and how I met you was when we were in the press room,
right?
And you were also a speaker this year too. So I saw you in there, and I went, "Oh my God, you're there!"
That was a good conference. It's always one of my favorite conferences. So
it is mine too. So we always talk about learning, technology, and the future of industries and jobs. And so I kick off my show where I ask my guests, what are 5 words that describe you and why those 5 words? And you had shared passionate, but when we were talking off the air. So why passionate?
I think because I truly believe in what I do. Everything, even when I was, we talk about my career, but I was a classroom teacher and a building administrator. My focus is always the kids. And so they were my passion. And the technology can do so much for our students and our educators that that's my way to support the entire community. So I'm really passionate. And I think it's really important for our students to have those skills.
I agree with you. How about determined? You mentioned determined.
I can talk about it now. Nobody ever thought I would be good at math. They never thought I would be good at being administrator. Never thought I would be a CTO or a tech director for school districts. And whenever someone, I'm sure you're the same way, whenever someone says you can't do it, you're going to do it. And so I'm determined to be the best person I can and not to listen to all that noise around me.
Oh, I love that. I am the same way. Like you, if somebody says, no, you're never going to do that. And I'm going, if it's not bad for me, yes, I will. Yeah. How about fighter? You mentioned fighter.
Yeah, because I part of it's my medical history, and I've at one point I was paralyzed and came back from that, and so I've always been like always fighting just to be in the game a lot. And being a woman in both corporate world and in education world, you really have to be a fighter to be heard and to be seen. I love men, but they have a little bit of an edge lift up than we do. And sometimes we have to fight for what we want that in a way that maybe men don't have to.
Oh, I agree with you totally. Because you'll rarely see women that run schools, you know, in that really high up ranking place, like president of a college. I've seen it shift somewhat, but honestly, it's usually men. So I agree.
Yeah.
How about supportive? You said supportive.
So in all my roles, I've always had a team, and my job is to support them. I always felt that I had the best people around me, but I needed to protect them. I needed to support them, and I needed to help them grow enough that they leave the job and go on to better things. And that has happened quite a few times. So my goal is to support and nurture future tech leaders or future, you know, administrators or classroom teachers. And so it's not about me, it's about them.
Yeah, I agree. I'm really glad to hear you mention that you know, you want to grow them. It's like you kiss them, bless them, and release them. And that's what I'm hearing. And very few employers want to do that. When really, if you're really taking into account what that other person needs, you do what they're asking for, not what you want to do.
Right. Right. Yeah. And like, you know, give them agency to have new ideas and new ways of doing things. And because it's shouldn't be very focused on my thoughts. So once you give them that agency and give them, just like you said, let them fly a little bit, it's amazing what they can do. Mm-hmm. And I'm so proud of anybody I work with and seeing how they've grown and gone on to do much better things.
Mm-hmm. Empathetic, our last word.
I think there's a couple of ways, and I'm talking about this, but I think my favorite way of talking about this is when I was a classroom teacher, and you know, we talked about Dr. Adolph Brown and the backpack that students bring into classrooms. Is they have so much they're dealing with outside of my classroom that when they come in and have a bad day, it's not about me. And sometimes classroom teachers feel like, okay, I'm going to engage with this person, I'm going to fight with this person because they have a bad attitude. But we really have to be empathetic and understand that most of the time it has nothing to do with us, and that we have to be able to you know, make sure those kids are safe and supported, because that's what we're there for. And I've seen in my career a lot of times where that's not the case. So our students these days come with so much on their backs, and COVID didn't help at all.
No, because you lose that sense of belonging with others, and the ability. They're desperate in those mid to middle and high school years to be, to belong. And they're trying so hard to figure out who they are.
I mean, I had one student when I was a assistant principal, come to find out him and his brother were, had just moved from the city into this district, and they were getting their lunch out of the garbage. Hmm. And then I had one student who said, told me a couple times that he's always hungry. And so, like, how can you let that happen at all? And so I made sure that they got on the free reduced lunch program. I signed them up and everything else. But it's like, we don't always see those things, or we tend to ignore them, and we can't. We can't at all. So
that's very true. So we're going to switch the conversation around now. Where did you go to school, and how did you end up to where you are now as a consultant? You can tell us anything you want about that story.
Well, you started off with saying, you know, so what, you know, what made you get into education? And it's
right.
it's interesting. I went to college to be a lawyer. I was working in a law library and taking all these poli-sci classes and realized I'm not political. I took one accounting class and fell in love. So switch majors, switch schools, and got my undergrad in accounting. And I did that for 15 years. Absolutely loved it. I love working with numbers. But then I had kids, and I stayed home with my kids for 8 years and started volunteering in their classrooms, doing math projects with them, and decided that that was a passion that I didn't even know I had. Education was never in my scope of what I was going to do. And so, you know, substitute teached. And then I went back to school at 40 years old, taking 5 to 6 calculus classes, college level calculus classes, just to get in the program, the teaching program. I would be there with 18 year olds who barely could get to class because it was raining or it was cold or it was cloudy. So I did that. So that's where my determination comes from. And then I became a high school math teacher and loved doing that. And then just opportunities kept coming along from there to math department head to, you know, assistant principal. And then I always loved tech. Even when I was in corporate, I always loved tech and new innovation. And I had a really good tech director in one of my districts who I was the one who got to play with the new toys, and I was the one he you know, piloted things on. And so when prior to that, most tech directors were computer science has computer science degree. So it was never, well, I was never going to get there. But because I had this tech director as a mentor, I was starting to get to what I think I needed to be a good tech director. And tech directors have changed. They're not the IT person in the room with the servers. They're instructional leaders as well as technology leaders. So I kind of fit the bill, hiring the best network system admin people I could get. And I ran a couple of school districts for a while. And then I kind of retired. And then I had been writing for a long time. I had been consulting some with ed tech startups. So I kind of morphed into making my Bellosoft Consulting a full-time job. And it's been great. And now I'm also working at the state level in their Office of Ed Tech, doing contract work, kind of consulting with them as an ed tech leader, having that experience. So now I'm actually impacting teachers and educators and students at the state level, which is kind of cool. So, but I present a lot. I'm passionate about what I talk about. There are certain things that I think need to stay in the forefront of what we're doing in schools around technology.
Mm-hmm. So when you mentioned that you work with startups, I'm curious because I'm a startup, but we're having to rebuild. So now it's kind of like starting over again. What kind of startups are they? Ed tech startups, or are they something else like fintech maybe, because you have accounting?
I know, and I haven't even explored that, but my focus right now has been ed tech because I know what a tech director does. I know what a tech director's mentality is. And I know how a district runs. And so when we have startups that have a product and they want to get into districts, I can talk to them about what the districts are looking for, how to actually even get on a state bid list, talk to them about their data privacy policies, what cybersecurity things they have in place. So my goal is when they walk into a meeting with administrators or educators, they already have answers to the questions that the district is going to ask. Really important. And because when I've asked them, these startups, a couple of just basic questions, they didn't have the answers. So I kind of really coach them on that piece of it.
That's valuable, because I've been in, I'm going to send you over to, I was in a fellowship program that's for ed tech and future of work startups. And you'd be a great guest speaker over there. It's called, oh gosh, just a minute. Let me think about it. I should know this one. Transcend Network. Have you heard of them? Transcend.
No.
Yeah. So I'll send you over there to the leadership team. They always bring experts in to come and talk with the startups. They'll bring in about 30 or 40, and it's a fellowship. So it's a 5-week program. And we didn't ever have anybody that talked with us about the things that you were mentioning. And I think, oh, that would be handy. So it would be a way to gain access to more startups on a global level, though.
Excellent. And I love the energy that the startups have and their innovation. But they have to be grounded in some basic things that they sometimes don't even think about because they're focusing on the product itself. So, go ahead.
Yeah, I was going to say most of them are in education, but I doubt that they have very much cybersecurity background, because that's not necessarily their area of specialty. But you would be a great asset there.
Great. Thank you for that.
Yeah.
Anytime I can help.
You were going to finish something and I interrupted you. I'm so sorry.
Oh, so I'm working on a kind of a guidebook because I'm talking to these startups. They don't even know how to approach districts. What do they have? Local control? Do they have state control? Do they have to get on certain bid lists? What's their data privacy policies in these states? And so I'm creating like kind of my book, kind of just like, this is what each state does. This is who you need to connect with. This is things you need to do before you go into a district. Because some districts won't even talk to you if you're not on certain lists. So I'm hearing a lot of interest in that. So that's kind of my latest little project.
That is really handy. And the fact that you're Obviously, extending it so that it's in every state makes it easier for them to scale because then they have that information. In the cities and the counties and the state areas, they would always have different point people, no matter what level of governance that is covering them. So I like that idea because, yeah, I'm pretty sure, I don't know, maybe chat could do something like that, but... You know, you stick with it. I think it's very valuable.
And you know who I'm finding the most valuable from it is other startups coming from other countries.
Yes.
Because we don't have a minister of education for the country.
No.
Where some of these different countries have those. And so it's a totally different model, a lot of local control within states, out of states. So, yeah. So that's kind of my new little project.
Well, I like that. That's it's very useful, honestly. So you're recognized as a thought leader with the Consortium for School Networking, and let's see if I get it right, COSEN.
COSEN, right.
All right. So tell us more about this organization and their work.
So COSEN is a national organization that focuses on tech directors. While ISTE is more focused on educators, and now they're more curriculum with ASCD. COSEN is really an organization for tech directors. So, you know, they do playbooks, they do toolkits, they have events, they have webinars, they have courses, they have a great community, lots of different committees. They have a federal level influence as well. So they advocate for connectivity, you know, digital equity, E-rate, having cybersecurity be part of E-rate. So there are advocates for tech directors in states, and they do a lot of great work. And so I've been involved with them for a long time, and I got to take a plug for this, is I am a CETL, which is a Certified Educational Technology Leader, because tech directors are not recognized in states with a license or certification. So COSEN has created this certification program that I'm actually part of to get the best people recognized and in supporting them in their roles in districts. So.
That's very interesting. You mentioned something, E-rate. What does that mean?
E-rate is discounted funding that school districts get. So if they're purchasing something in their infrastructure, or they have to go through this process of applying for E-rate, whether it's and Cat 1 or Cat 2, depending on what it is. And then if it's approved, then they buy the products, and they get reimbursed for a large part of the cost of these products. Mm. So in the case of cybersecurity, there's no local funding, there's no state funding. And so the only way that districts can actually implement cybersecurity programs is to get a discounted or reimbursed rate from the federal government. It's quite a process, but they've been fighting to get that on an E-rate list.
Wow. Thanks for sharing that.
Yeah.
I'm sure now I sell to employers, but the government could be one of my customers, honestly. So since I don't sell to school districts, but I sell to employers would you say that this E-rate information would be helpful for me to do business with them?
You can't do business with them, but you should be knowledgeable about it.
Okay.
Because that's how it's going to impact purchasing through a district.
Okay. Schools are free for me, and so are students. I sell to employers that want to work with interns, and we help them, just so you understand, employers be compliant with the Department of Labor's criteria as well as NACE, and we accelerate skills-based recruitment and learning for not only the student, but also with the employers.
Excellent.
Thanks.
Yeah.
So,
but if you ever work, if any of your audience is ever thinking about working with school districts, they really should kind of get some knowledge. Every school district has an E-rate consultant. We don't do the work ourselves. It's that complicated.
Wow. That sounds very complicated. Is this on your website also? Do you explain this?
You just given me a good new idea. So
okay, great.
Yeah, I'm gonna add that. That's a really good point.
Yeah, because I know when I went to your website, you did have a blog and you have things that you've been published and other areas of videos that people can watch and all of that. And, you know, it's a wealth of information, but I did not know about the E-rate stuff. So great. I'll look for that article.
Yeah, definitely. I think that's good. And I think some of my startups would probably benefit from that information as well.
Oh, I'm sure they would. So who are some of your favorite thought leaders and why? You mentioned Diane Dorsch. So who is she?
Diane Dorsch is the chair of the COSIN board. She also works at Digital Promise. She's a former tech director in Green Bay. She's absolutely amazing. She was adopted from Thailand, and she has been an advocate for equity, racial equity. Mm-hmm. And those kind of things, because that's what she feels is important. She does a lot of good work. She's a smart woman, and I really respect what she's doing.
While you have been mentioning them, all of these great people, I am actually looking them up and I am connecting them on the show notes with their LinkedIn profiles so that people hopefully will be able to check them out and see them. The next woman was Marlo Gaddis.
She was a tech director of one of the largest school districts in the country, and she's in North Carolina, and now she's consulting. She's kind of retired from ed tech, but she's been on the COSIN board. She's a great speaker. I learned a lot from her when I was just getting in to be a tech director. So she's also works very closely with some of the local affiliations of COSIN, and again, another knowledgeable, well-respected person in the industry.
Very nice. Yep, I found her, and she's over here on the COSIN board, just like you mentioned.
Yeah.
So I don't know, Ken Shelton, are they all from COSIN? Is that how you know them?
No, I know Ken, I think it was from FETC when we were in Miami. So that was January 2020, I met him. I heard him speak, and so I interviewed him. He's really about equity, racial equity, around learning. And he speaks very a lot. He's a well-known speaker, and now his focus on is AI, which is really interesting, but it comes from a different lens, and he's a disruptor in a really good way. So he's another one to follow.
Mm-hmm.
He's been around for a little while, and now he seems to be really getting the recognition he deserves. But if anybody has a chance to hear him speak, I highly recommend it.
Well, I think I found his speaker page, and he looks like he's like, I don't know, mid-30s. He looks pretty young.
Yeah, but wise beyond his years. And he gets you to think differently.
I love that.
I think that's important. So.
Yeah, very, very good. Yeah, definitely. You've had so many great people that you had mentioned, you know, on the show and off show. So I've hyperlinked those for the guests that listen to the show. And I hope they go check them out, because they look phenomenal. Yeah.
I wouldn't be where I am if it wasn't for those people.
Mm.
They have made me a better person and a better professional.
Very nice. So what hard lesson have you experienced that gave you a deeper understanding of empathy? I know you mentioned this up at the beginning when you were talking about one of your words, and you also mentioned Dr. Adolf Brown, the Two Backpacks book, but what was it that made you go, maybe I need to take a step back?
I think it was when I was a building administrator in a district that was mainly Irish, Italian, all white. And I'm Jewish, which I don't look at because I converted. So they would have conversations with me about Jewish people. I had a department head in a cabinet meeting say out loud that he doesn't understand why the Jews need so many holidays.
Oh, no.
Called him to the task. So I had to learn to, what I did was I had to make sure people knew I was Jewish so I didn't put them in a situation that I would feel uncomfortable.
Mm-hmm.
So my national, my religion, you can't see it, but we have so many students that they can see. And I am so much empathy for these immigrants that are coming to our country, these, students of color. I've had some situations where there are teachers of color who don't stay in a district because they're harassed. So I am having a tiny taste of what that's like. I am very empathetic. Have you ever read the book White Fragility?
No, I haven't heard of it.
I recommend it for everybody because it really helps you to understand your own implicit biasses, and it gets you thinking differently and being more empathetic to everyone. It's uncomfortable, but it's definitely worth the read.
I like that. Okay. I do enjoy those kind of books that are self-reflective and makes you question the things that we take for granted about our own life.
Yeah. Dana, do you know, it's like, I was insulted, like, that's not me. That's not me. But then when you start reading, you're like, oh, that is me. So, but it makes us better people.
Yep. Was there a teacher in your life that helped you realize that you wanted to be in education? I know we mentioned this, but you figured it out not because of a teacher.
Right. Exactly. I didn't find out that way, but, I had one teacher in high school that was the art teacher. And I was at that point fairly good at art, and I was skinny and unpopular, and she kind of took me under her wings. So she made me feel safe. She made me feel important. But I would have to say that people that I have come across in education, I think it's important to say, have told me I couldn't do certain things. I would never be good at math. I would never be good at writing. And so they almost were the best examples, because that is not what I wanted to be as a teacher, as an administrator. And it actually pushed me to do the things that they said I couldn't do. So it, I think it worked out okay.
It did. It absolutely did. I'm really glad to hear that. I know you mentioned that you had children, so I'm sure that these little lessons have been something that have made you a better mom, but certainly a better educator. So you have bigger impact.
It was interesting. Both my kids, they're in their 30s now. Both my kids wrote their college essays about me.
Really?
Yeah. And I obviously sent some kind of example, or I did something right, but
it's nice. It's nice when they acknowledge moms. I always appreciate that so much. There's been a couple of shows that I've seen where, I know this was something that was on Facebook. It was on a college campus, and this was just this week. I'm not on Facebook. It must have been YouTube, because that's where I am. And they were interviewing these guys that were coming through the dorm. They said, how often do you call your mom? And they asked all of them. And I was so surprised. Every single one of them did call their mom, but some of them called their mom every day. And I went, and they said, well, that's my mom, of course. And these are young men that are probably 20, 21. So, and they were proud of it. I'm so glad to have seen that. So yeah. Cool that your kids did it. I hope that you went and you took those things and you made it like a framed, you know, memory on the wall.
I've not done that, but that's a really good idea. You can
It'll probably make your husband just a little bit disappointed. So maybe they can do that for him for Father's Day sometime. But you got it first.
I got it first.
That's right. So what would you want to be remembered for in your life?
That I was loved and that I loved. I don't need accolades. I don't need letters after my name. I don't need say I wrote a book or I get this award or anything else. I just want to be a kind person, and I want people to think of me that way. And that's how I want to be remembered. Just loved and to be loved and to love.
Yeah. I'm going to tell you, just about every one of my guests, I'll say probably 3 out of 5 usually says that they just hope that they let people know that they were loved. And the other two, it's never about them either. They just say something that's different. They, you know, that they hope that they could help people to be seen. It's still saying the same thing,
yeah.
You know, but just about every guest that has come on has always had a heart for making sure that people felt heard and seen and could fit in.
And
or just who they were.
Right, exactly. And one of my jobs, I always feel is my job, is to make sure our students are safe, especially around technology with data privacy. And my job is to make sure that their information doesn't get out and has an impact on their future. So I feel if I can do my best to educate districts about this, then I feel like I can rest in peace that we're doing something good for our students.
I would agree. Yeah.
That's not as sexy as being loved, but.
I don't know. I think it's okay that we feel that, you know, a need that falls under Maslow's theory, right? That, you know, the highest form of enlightenment is just being able to understand, you know, yourself and others. And it's okay to be loved. We all have that. We're human and we need to be loved just as much as we need to love others.
Right.
Yeah. So we're going to take a break and acknowledge our sponsor, Cat 5 Studios, and we will be right back.
The Intern Whisperer is brought to you by Cat 5 Studios, who help you create games and videos for your training and marketing needs that are out of this world. Visit Cat 5 Studios for more information to learn how Cat 5 Studios can help your business. Thank you, Cat 5 Studios.
Now we're in the second half of the show with Eileen Bellestock, and this has been delightful, so I'm looking forward to talking about this next. On this part of the show, we always talk about, what do you think 2030 is going to look like in the world? And it's so hard to believe. I mean, you know, we're 2024, but it's not that far away. And when we're talking about it, tell us what you think it would look like in the world as the education industry and potential jobs. And this is an opinion, so there's no right or wrong.
That's a big question.
Kevin Kelly. So if you want to draw from that inspiration.
Kevin Kelly. What was the name of the book?
Inevitable.
Oh, and The Inevitable. And it talks about the 12 technological forces that will shape our future.
I'm going to go get that book.
Very insightful. I learned a lot from reading it. And it's good. I think it applies now and it's going to apply in the future. I'd like to think education, that students are going to have more agency around how they learn and where they learn and what they learn, that was still in the mentality of the old schoolhouse mentality. And I think the pandemic kind of shifted us a little, but it's kind of going back to that. I know I became a math teacher mainly because I learned differently, and I know students learn differently, and I wanted to nurture that. I don't feel a lot of us had that opportunity when we were growing up. So I think, I think students having that opportunity is one thing. I think, and I'm going to keep saying my digital equity, I really think everybody should have connectivity. I think that's important. I mean, Miami has 5G all over the streets so that people have connectivity walking down the street. but there are districts who don't have students who don't have any connectivity. And that really makes their life small. So, so around that, I think, you know, we talked about the fourth and fifth industrial revolution about, you know, where there are jobs out there that have not been created yet that we're not preparing students for. But I think, again, it gets around, you know, empowering our students, embracing their experiences, their knowledge, their passions. And I think that's going to translate into some amazing things. I also feel, and people maybe not think this is good, you know, people don't want to do automatic checkout lines at grocery stores. They want their cashiers to do it. They don't want, my doctor's office now has a online check-in, so you don't actually go to registration anymore. So I think we need to really focus on shifting from doing those kind of jobs to jobs that really are creative. I feel like sometimes we're just so focused on the mundane things we're doing, even as educators, you know, taking attendance and, you know, doing all these things, that if we could get away from that, then we could be focusing on, I don't even know, but I think that's how a lot of things come about, you know, disruptors, people saying, oh, there's a better way or an easier way. And I'm planning on enjoying 2030 and seeing what comes out.
Mm-hmm.
But technology is going to be a big part of it.
So I'm going to give you a question I didn't get to share with you. So this one's going to be coming out of left field for you. I'm always in this place where just because we can do something doesn't mean that we should. And if I'm taking the job away from the person that greets me when I come into a McDonald's or a Walmart, that makes me sad, because I do think that these jobs, that they may seem mundane, but there are people that are not going to be programmers. There are people that do not have either the intellect ability, or they may not have the desire. They just enjoy just making somebody smile when they come in the store. And that's just one example. Yeah. So I sit here and I go, I don't think we should take all of that away, because I feel like it needs to be there to help those that will not hit those. Otherwise, I'm kind of concerned that we become more like a Hitler.
Well, that's interesting. You know, you're absolutely right. And I you know, if I gave that impression, it's kind of not what I was going towards. My dad.
No, you weren't, but you made me think of that, because it's a question that I like to ask the guests and go, well,
my dad won't take his tray. Like, if he goes to a fast food store, restaurant, he leaves his tray on the table, because if he takes it, that's someone's job.
Yeah, I agree with your dad.
As simple as that. I don't think we're providing workforce skills to a lot of people. I mean, we have a lot of immigrants coming over here with little or different skills, and we're not, as a country, supporting, you know, families in poverty. You know, are we providing them with a free education, you know, free retraining? Because they don't have the education doesn't mean they can't do it, given the right situation. I mean, it's very expensive to get a degree. It's very expensive in some families to even go to high school, because if their kids are in high school, then they're not earning, they're not contributing to the rent. That's outrageous. So I think we need to support our families a lot more, and maybe they will. I love the greeters. I mean, that's that personal, that person in the whole thing. But we should give opportunities to people who want to do something differently. And right now we don't. They don't have a lot of options. So,
you know, one of the things, when I ride Uber or Lyft, I've noticed that, and when we talk about immigrants, this is something I've asked. My question that I always ask them when I get in the car, and I use Google Translator, because Google Translator es mi amigo, Duolingo es mi amigo. So, you know, I say, ¿cómo está? Yo hablo español un poquito. So I put all of that out there, because they're just about always from Venezuela or someplace in Central or South America, and they speak Spanish. And I ask them, what what did they do? What was their work in their country? And then why did they come here? And then I asked them, why do they like this? They love driving Uber or Lyft because they honestly feel that it helps them control whatever contributions they can do. And they find it very, very, they love it because they get to talk with people if they want to. And then they've also shared that coming into a country, even if they're not, we have a lot of Spanish down here in Florida, immigrants. But when they come here, they have to take the ESOL classes so they can learn how to speak. And then, you know, it costs money. But driving has been something that's very, very helpful for them to be able to provide for their family. And one of them, who barely spoke English, had said that she's gone into real estate. She was so excited. She told me she had sold 3 houses and she had been there 3 years. And I went, wow, that's really inspiring. She was very young. She uses her money to help her family back at home and in her other country. And she was able to buy herself a nice car. She was able to, you know, have a living here. So sometimes it changes the direction, but some of them were attorneys, some of them were doctors, and they can't get they'd have to go back to school all over again to be that. So I understand that. I mean, I understand the credentialing process there too, but.
And, you know, I had families who the iPad that I gave the student for school was the only device they had in the house.
Yeah.
And so how do they apply for jobs? How do they get a higher education? You know, how do they get those skills if they don't even have technology or connectivity to be able to do it? Mm-hmm. So I think my first step would be connectivity for all, and then maybe free healthcare, but
yeah. I'm grateful that we have libraries that are beginning to morph into something new down here in Florida, in Orlando. We have a 5-star library that has simulation computers and things where students can learn. Anybody can go in and learn how to program. Whether it's in the game industry or if it's in games, they have makerspace. They have so many things available, and it's all free because it's part of having a library card and anybody can come in. So I'm glad to see that there are resources that are shifting to provide another way for people to get exactly like what you're talking about, access when they may not have it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I know that was like in a complete different direction, but it was good.
Okay, it was a good conversation.
I hope you were comfortable with it.
No, okay. I was.
Okay, good. So what impact, positively or negatively? We're going to talk about Gen AI and the future of work. What do you think it's going to have? The positive side of it, we can call it challenges, negative, but whatever you want to call it. Because here's the thing. The creator of AI, Jeffrey Hinton, was interviewed on 60 Minutes about AI. He created it. He is called the godfather of AI, and he stated one of the ways in which these systems might escape control by us is by writing their own computer code to modify themselves. And that's something, Jeffrey said, we need to seriously worry about. And he was on 60 Minutes October 8th last year. So I was mesmerized by this man. I am trying so hard to see if I can find him, but I don't know if I can get him to be a guest on my show because he was on 60 Minutes. But nonetheless, I'll ask. But anyway, what are your thoughts about all of that?
I think that's interesting. And I think what I'm reading about, and I'm actually getting some certification in it, is you have to have the human in the loop.
Mm-hmm.
There has to be, it cannot be all computer. So if we're talking about even how the teachers are using it for lesson plans or presentation, if people are using presentations, it's only as good as the information it has. And while it's still learning, you really have to have the human component. We offer things that computers don't offer. We have emotions. We have different ways of, we don't always think logically, but it doesn't mean it's not correct. And I think AI right now is learning, but there's a lot it's still struggling with. And I think it will continue to struggle with. Some of the good things that it's doing is helping us to differentiate learning for students. It's providing mm-hmm. us resources. I think it's helping, I'm talking about education, it's helping teachers think differently.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I remember when I was a math teacher having to go online trying to find anything, to, you know, on talking about velocity with my seniors, which would make any kind of impact on them and has anything to do with real life. And what AI can do is actually give me those resources or ideas. I have to actually implement them and make them that so it's enjoyable and it gets
accessible.
Accessible, right? So I think that's important. Educators sometimes think, well, you know, this whole new AI thing is new and it's scary and we don't want our kids using it, but AI has been in technology for a really long time. I refer to like Grammarly. Students and teachers been using Grammarly for a really long time, even yep. like Duolingo and those kind of things. A lot of our software already has some kind of AI in it, but we just have to be thoughtful and keep that human in the loop. For me, I think some of the, and I think that for me, I always focus especially on cybersecurity. And, you know, botnets are basically AI, and they go in and they kind of bury into your school system and you don't even know they're there until months later. So that makes me nervous, is the capability of AI for cybersecurity. But AI also can help us detect cybersecurity incidents that the human eye cannot see. I mean, you have people monitoring it all the time, but AI can really get down to the granular and also help us prevent or mitigate any cybersecurity attacks. So I know what he's saying, but in my opinion, it's only going to get, and I don't have his expertise because he's the creator of all of it. Mm-hmm. The only way it's going to get out of hand is if we let it get out of hand.
Right. I agree.
So yeah, it's not going to write its own code unless at some point we rely on it to do everything.
Yeah. I think the cautionary tale is in place, right?
Yep.
Yeah. So definitely.
But we talk about AI for our innovative technology forever. So I think it's here and it's we got to make sure we deal with it. But right now it seems like, I hate to say it this way, a shiny new toy.
Yeah, it is. It is. I think that there's a lot of ethics that need to be built around it. So I look for the groups that are talking about ethics. I look for that with AI, whether they're on LinkedIn. I follow those people that are the groups, and I go, where can I join? Because I would like to be a part of that conversation. And to a certain extent, it makes me feel like I'm being very proactive in it, instead of just sitting by the sidelines. A lot of people do that, not you or I. I think that you're very, very engaged in all of this. And obviously, because, you know, you're choosing to specialize also in cybersecurity. So you're definitely, you know, dialed in. But if there's any groups, where are you located? What state?
Massachusetts.
Yeah. Okay. So up there, that's like MIT, Boston. I mean, you know, Harvard, everything's up there.
That's where Watson is.
Yes.
I've been to where the building where Watson is over in Cambridge.
Oh my gosh. So,
very cool. I agree with you with the ethics thing, and especially with education, there is implicit bias that's going on. Mm-hmm. There's not a lot of culturally relevant teaching going on through AI. If that ever happens, it's only because we're going to teach it how to do it. Even their image maker, Dolly,
mm-hmm.
it's all the figures look alike.
Mm-hmm.
And they may make them Asian or, you know, Brazilian or whatever it is.
But the model's the same.
They still look white.
Mm-hmm.
And so they have a long way to go for it to be equitable.
Mm-hmm.
I'm assuming it will learn it somewhere down the line, but only if we teach it the right way. So if we don't teach the AI the right way, then it's never going to be equitable and ethical.
Yeah, you raise a really valid point, is to focus on what we're training the tools. Like way back, I can remember it was a voice activation where we could train the, I think it was train the dragon or something like that. And you were teaching your computer to recognize your voice, and then it would dictate messages. This is before it became a thing.
Oh, I remember that. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. That was like, I don't think it was that long ago. It might have been 8 years ago, maybe 10, something like that.
It wasn't that long ago.
Yeah. It seems forever long, but not really. Anyway, you know, there's all of these advances, and it moves so fast, so incredibly fast, that we don't notice how fast it is moving. And something, when a startup is in stealth mode, we may never even know until it's like, boom, next day you go, oh, what just happened? Because they've been in stealth and they've been hiding what they're doing.
It's, and we have to almost go slow to go fast. And I think that doesn't always happen.
That's solid. I'm putting that down as part of your mentoring advice. We have to go slow to be fast. Yes, that is very, very good. I know you have something else that you want to say, but that's like Eileen wisdom right there.
Wisdom, right.
Okay.
And that's how I lead too, you know. But yeah, we have to step back and really look at it, and not be in panic mode either. Like, do some deep analysis. And you know, New York banned it from schools one week, and then the next week they unbanned it from schools.
Really?
So I think being reactive instead of proactive seems to be happening in pockets around the country.
Is it parents that driving that, or maybe teachers, or both?
It's interesting. I think a lot of it's teachers, mm-hmm. and there are a lot of them who embrace it. I think a lot of them, because it's also, we had to train people on AI.
Yeah.
You know, I'm creating a strategic planning guide for tech directors in Massachusetts. It's like, we have to teach our teachers the technology and how to use it before they can use it with kids. So
exactly,
we AI has to be the same thing. We can't throw programs that have AI into a classroom and let them say, okay, is it okay to use it? Is it not okay to use it? How do I tell if the student's cheating? How do I not? You know, it has to be a district or statewide focus. And we're seeing that already, that states like California and Oregon have statewide AI policies. The U.S. Department of Ed has just come out with a document about AI that has a lot of really good points in it and good recommendations. So and school districts are just starting to do that themselves, but we have to. So we have to kind of really put policies in place.
Mm-hmm.
And training, so that we can use it. I mean, when the graphing calculator came out, you know, everybody thought that was cheating.
Yeah.
And we use that reference a lot, but I think we have to educate people.
Yeah. And I think you raised such a perfect valid point right there when you had mentioned that the school districts were no, and then they were yes. And then in all of that turmoil that was going on, there's part of the realization is that, oh, well, we need to put a plan in place before we try to roll it out. And that takes some time to make sure we're doing it in, you know, best practices way, ethically, we're being informed. None of us are being biased or prejudiced towards it. It's like, you have to get your leaders all on the same page too. Change management, right? So
yeah. And we're talking like that, but at the state level, we're talking about systems need to be in place.
Yeah.
There's a really good book called The Power of Habits.
I've heard of that one.
Yeah. It kind of reminds me of Atomic Habits, but about corporations, about putting systems in place.
Mm-hmm.
That's how you improve your revenue, your product is higher quality, and you retain people. So I think we need to put systems in place around AI and not wait till, like I said, proactive versus reactive. So
yeah, and for our listeners, that's Charles Duhigg.
Yeah, great book.
Yeah, I have that one, and it's been sitting on my shelf. I had pulled it out just last week. I went, I have not read this book, and I know that we've been talking about it, so I'm really glad that you brought that one up. So thanks for doing
that. I give it to people as a gift because I think it's really, it relates to everyday life, and it relates to business, it relates to education, it relates to everything.
Mm, that's a good point, too. Yeah. Okay, so it's so hard to believe. We're almost to the next to last question is, what is the best mentoring advice that you would want to pass on to our listeners?
Mentoring advice. I think be a listener, not a talker. I think mentees do not need us talking at them. We need to really figure out where their strengths are and help them develop them more, and then find out where their, weaknesses, and find out how to improve it. And you can only do that by listening. And I think to me, that's the key. I've done it in, as a leader in districts, I'm a mentor for tech directors through COSIN. So I mentor emerging tech directors. So a lot of it is just having, oh, and I also, another thing I say is connect them to other people, network them. So when I'm talking to a CTO and they're talking about a particular problem they have, I know other CTOs who have solved the problem or who are working on the problem together. And the best way we can do things is together. I am not the expert on everything. And that's one thing I don't recommend, is trying to be the expert, but just being able to guide them is really important. And they're amazing. I mean, the next generation of tech directors and educators and startups are just amazing. You don't want to get in their way. But you kind of, you look through things with a different lens than they do, and it just makes them stronger.
Well, I think those were wonderful pieces of wisdom that you shared. So thanks so much for doing that. Now, how can our listeners contact you? Website, social channels? We included your LinkedIn and your X/Twitter, but what's your website?
My website is EileenBellostock.com. Pretty simple. LinkedIn, if you're trying to get a hold of me, is a really good way to get a hold of me. Definitely follow me on Twitter. I follow a lot of great thought leaders. And so if people are interested to see what's going on, I think it's really important to stay on top of what's going on social media. You don't use it like social activity, but use it for professional. I recommend to my mentees that they have a professional Twitter account and, of course, a professional LinkedIn account.
Yes. It's surprising how many people still may not have LinkedIn. I go, that's the only one that's all business. Come on now.
Yeah. And I've made a lot of good connections. I have my network just keeps growing because there's so many amazing people out there. But network, send messages to people, you reference them an article they wrote, repost it, retweet it, whatever. And that goes a long way.
Yeah, it does. I agree. Well, I want to thank you so much again for being a guest on the show. You've been phenomenal. So look for this show to be dropping in March. I think I said March 13th. I'm not sure. I'm going to check up here at the top. March 12th. So thanks again. And I'm going to be in touch. We're going to make sure that we're supporting one another.
Yeah, we don't want to wait till another FETC conference.
No, we do not.
Absolutely.
Anyway, thank you.
Well, thank you very much.
Thank you to our sponsor, Cat5 Studios, and thank you to our video editing team, Max Stein, Luke Belaja, and Chris Rodriguez. Music is by Sophie Lloyd. Visit Employers for Change at www.e4c.tech to learn how you can recruit, assess, and improve employee learning and company culture through DEI skills hiring and learning. Mention you listen to the show when you join and become a member, and you may win a chance to be a guest on the Intern Whisperer podcast. Subscribe today to our podcast and support the Intern Whisperer by sharing, leaving us comments, and reviews. You can find the Intern Whisperer podcast on Employers for Change YouTube channel or streaming from your favorite podcast channel.